hear it. But I respected her, he continued. She was dutiful. She was a good woman. My father chose her for me because she was a virtuous girl, even though he knew I loved someone else. And this is why I never chose any woman for you. I wanted you to find a woman you loved. Don't make this about me. Who else is it about? He closed his eyes once more, and from downtown to the apartment, we didn't speak again. When we reached his bedroom, I had to help him take off his shirt and lie down, holding him by the shoulders while he braced his neck and head. I saw the 6-inch scar in his chest that I'd sometimes seen as a child, after he'd come out of the shower with a towel around his waist. Since he'd never told us anything about what he'd done in the war, we made up stories about how he'd been shot through the chest or stabbed by the husband of one of his mistresses. The scar was a vivid bolt of red lightning in my memory, angled between his sternum and his heart. But in the dim light of his bedroom, it was only a pink zipper holding the rumpled, loose skin of his chest together. I found sleeping pills in a drawer of his nightstand, along with a bottle of eucalyptus oil and a box of Salonpas. Take one, I said, dropping a pill in his mouth. He swallowed it without water, and I rolled him over, because even that act required a man to use the muscles of his neck. I splashed some of the eucalyptus oil onto his shoulders and neck and began massaging him. Soon enough he was breathing evenly, and once he was asleep, I bandaged him with the white strips of Salonpas, their medicinal scent reminding me of the times when he would lay them upon me after particularly hard mornings of exercise. After I was done, I picked up his shirt and opened the closet. The hanger was in my hand when I glanced at the shelf above the closet rod and saw my mother's wig, resting on its styrofoam head. What compelled him to save this, of all things, was beyond me. I hung up the shirt quickly and turned off the lights before I went to my room. There I lay in bed, listening for the police helicopters that cruised overhead almost every night, or the Spanish rock that was always floating up from the crowded evangelical church down the hill. But everything was so strangely still and quiet. I thought I wasn't even in my own apartment, and when I closed my eyes, I saw the head's oval face once again, marked by an arched nose and thin lips, its expression white, blank, and eyeless, as it gazed down upon me. Late the following day, the police found my father's Honda on a side street of Boyle Heights. The next morning, while I was sleeping between shifts, my father went with Mimi to retrieve it from the impound lot. They returned by the time I was awake and drinking my coffee, black and without sugar. My father was whistling a tune I didn't recognize when he opened the door, Mimi trailing behind him. "Miracles do happen after all," he said. "The car's in one piece. The police think it was just stolen by kids looking for a joyride." "Lucky you," I said. "The little bastard's even left me a gift," he chuckled and showed me a cheap removable stereo in his palm, his movement stiff and awkward from his strained neck. I guess they couldn't stand the radio. "The stereo's probably stolen, too." "Well, if the police don't have a problem with it, then neither do I." After he went outside with a vacuum cleaner and rags to clean up the car, I was left alone with Mimi. She sat on the edge of the futon, wearing a purple satin tracksuit with clean white sneakers, hands folded on her lap as she smiled at me. The early morning sun coming through the living room windows reflected off the satin and illuminated her in the halo of dust floating up from the futon. Seeing her with my father made me think that perhaps Sam had made the right choice after all. Perhaps she was thinking of my father and mother when she divorced me. Perhaps she knew then what I know now, that they never should have married each other. The truth of the matter was that my father and mother should have married other people, even though, in that case, I might never have been born. "Sometimes I feel so sorry for you bachelors," she said. "Mimi, my housekeeper does a great job," she went on. "She's looking for some more work in case you need help cleaning." "Aunt Mimi," I said. The coffee's bitterness only made me aware of how dull my mind was. "She cooks, too, nearly as good as I can. You know he's going to cheat on you, don't you?" For a moment, she said and did nothing, her expression unchanging. I thought she might not have heard me, or if she had, that she was too shocked even to react. Then she stood up, brushing away the cloud of dust with a wave of her hand. I expected her to say something, perhaps how she was not like my mother, but she didn't say a word. Instead, she walked to the door without looking at me, a smile fixed on her face, and for a moment I believed she might just ignore me. But with her hand on the doorknob, she stopped and turned to look at me. "Tell me something," she said. The curve of her smile straightened into a thin, hard line. Aren't there times when you'd rather be someone else besides you? I went to work. Then I changed my clothes and went to work again. Near dawn of the next day, I came home from night duty and was so tired that I wasn't even aware of crossing the threshold of my bedroom and falling asleep. Not until a staccato pounding woke me up after what seemed like only minutes. Someone was knocking on the front door. The alarm clock said it was 7:30, and when I looked down, I saw that I was still wearing my pants. My shirt and shoes were on the carpet. I waited for my father to answer the door, but when the pounding only became more insistent, I had to climb out of bed. Whoever it was kept beating on the front door until I opened it. Sam was standing there, right hand raised and clenched. She was wearing an unbuttoned red cardigan over a black top and matching black pants made of stretchable wool. Her pregnant belly protruded over her waistband, and her top had ridden up, leaving an eye-shaped sliver of her flesh exposed. The navel at its center was like a pupil, its iris the gold belly ring she had acquired in her freshman year one drunken night. "I didn't know you had it in you," she said, brushing by me. The sunlight behind her was blinding. I blinked and said, "What?" "My car!" She pivoted in the middle of the living room to face me. "I spent all day yesterday getting it fixed. How could you do that? How?" My watchman's jacket was thrown onto the armchair by the door, and in the breast pocket was an envelope full of cash that I'd gotten from the bank during lunch yesterday. My plan had been to slide the unmarked envelope under her door that evening. I took the envelope out of the jacket and offered it to her. "What's that?" she said, arms folded above her belly. "It's enough to pay for the car." Sam looked at the envelope for a moment and hesitated. I kept myself very still. If I so much as shook the envelope or said another word, she'd refuse it and curse me on her way out. While she was making up her mind, the sight of her belly ring and the smooth, tight canopy of flesh it rested on transfixed me. I wondered if she'd named the baby yet, if she knew the sex of it, and above all, if she'd told the man who was going to be the father. "When I saw what you'd done to the car, part of me wanted to kill you," Sam said, taking the envelope. "But another part of me thought you cared in some strange, screwed-up way that was completely your own." I stepped forward and put my hand on her belly. "Mostly I wanted to kill you," she said, frowning. I leaned closer and put my other hand on her belly, the navel and the ring between my two hands. I waited for the baby to kick or to turn over in the womb, and when nothing happened, I knelt down and placed my ear against Sam's belly. There was a life hidden there, a life that if I were to hold it in my hands would weigh almost nothing. When I spoke, it was so softly that only the stranger curled up behind the belly ring could hear. Then I said it once more, louder. "I can be the father." Feeling Sam's hand grip my shoulder, I said it a third time, just to make sure they both heard me right. "Stand up, Thomas," she said. "I want you to stand up." I stood up. We faced each other, her belly buffering us. "Do you know what you're saying?" she asked. "Do you have any idea what you're doing?" "I have absolutely no idea," I said. Sam bit her lip and looked down, but she didn't back away. I saw a pattern of 3 age spots by her jawbone. They had not been there the year before, when we had drawn up the divorce agreement with pen and paper, without lawyers, and with a bottle of wine. I traced the slope of her cheek to the jaw, where the age spots were arranged like the dots on a die. A floorboard creaking in my father's room announced that he had crept out of bed and was undoubtedly standing against the door. Sam and I turned our heads to the sound, but we heard nothing more. He was waiting, just like we were, for what was to come. Fatherland. It was a most peculiar thing to do, or so everyone said on hearing the story, of how Fung's father had named his second set of children after his first. Fung was the eldest of these younger children, and for all of her 23 years she had believed that her father's other children were much more blessed. Evidence of their good fortune was written in the terse letters sent home annually by the mother of Fung's namesake, the first Mrs. Lee, who enumerated each of her children's accomplishments, height, and weight in bullet points. Fung's namesake, for example, was 7 years older, 15 centimeters taller, 20 kilos heavier, and, from the record in the photographs included with the letters, in possession of fairer, clearer skin, a thinner, straighter nose, and hair, clothing, shoes, and makeup that only became ever more fashionable as she graduated from a private girls' school, then from an elite college, followed by medical school, and then a residency in Chicago. Mr. Lee had laminated each of the photographs to protect them from humidity and fingerprints, keeping them neatly stacked on a side table by the couch in the living room. The letters accompanying the photographs were the only communiques that Fum's family received about the children, for over the course of some 27 years' absence, Fum's namesake and her two younger brothers had never written a word themselves. And so, when the first such letter finally arrived, it was the cause of a great deal of excitement. The letter was addressed to Mr. Lee, who, as the plenipotentiary of the house, always took it upon himself to open the mail. He sat on the couch and slit the envelope carefully, using one of the few relics from his past he had managed to keep, a silver letter opener with an ivory handle. Flanking him were Fung and her mother, while his two teenage sons, Hank and Fook, sat on the armrests and craned their necks to catch a glimpse of the words their father read out loud. The letter was even shorter than the ones written by the ex-wife, merely announcing that Fung's half-sister would be coming for a two-week vacation and that she hoped to stay with them. "Vivian?" Mrs. Lee said, reading the name signed at the bottom of the letter. "Is she too good to use the name you gave her?" But Fung knew instantly why her sister had taken upon herself a foreign name, and whose name it must have been. Vivian Lee, star of Gone with the Wind, her father's favorite film, as he had once told her in passing. Fung had seen the film on a pirated videotape and was seduced immediately by the glamour, beauty, and sadness of Scarlett O'Hara, heroine and embodiment of a doomed South. Was it too much to suppose that the ruined Confederacy, with its tragic sense of itself, bore more than a passing similarity to her father's defeated Southern Republic and its resentful remnants? It was easy, then, in the weeks leading to Vivian's arrival, for Fung to pass her days at home and at work constructing scenarios of a noble, kindly sister, somewhat solemn and sad, but nevertheless gentle and patrician, who would immediately take to her and become the mentor and guide Fung never had. Her first glimpse of Vivian at the airport only confirmed the appropriateness of such a movie star's name for the young woman who paused at the terminal's glass gates, her eyes hidden behind enormous sunglasses, her lips slightly parted in a glossy pout, pushing a cart loaded with her own weight in crimson luggage. As she jumped and waved to get Vivian's attention, Fung was thrilled to see that her sister bore utterly no resemblance to the throngs of local people waiting outside to greet the arrivals, hundreds of ordinary folk wearing drab clothes and fanning themselves under the sun. Even after a week in Saigon, Vivian would appear no more of a native than on the day she arrived, at least in outdoor settings. On the streets, at sidewalk cafes, or hopping into a taxi, she was easily mistaken for a Korean businessman's frazzled wife or a weary Japanese tourist, her frosting of makeup melting under the tropical glare. In certain indoor settings, however, she was clearly the mistress of her domain. This was the case at the restaurant Namkha, on the street Donghae, where Fung had worked as a hostess for the 2 years since her graduation from college. It was Vivian's idea to treat the family to dinner at Namkha, a way to celebrate the halfway point in her vacation, and something Fung would never have suggested, the restaurant's offerings being far more than Fung or her family could afford. "But it's a crime, don't you think?" Vivian said, glancing over the entrees. Their table was by the reflecting pool, across from which two young women sat upon a cushioned dais, wearing silken, ethereal aoyai, and plucking gently at the 16 strings of the zithers braced upon their laps. "You should be able to eat where you work at least once in your lifetime." "The real crime is $5 for morning glory fried in garlic," Mrs. Lee said. She sold silk at the Bentang market and possessed the eyes of an experienced negotiator, smooth and unreadable as the beads of an abacus. "I can buy this for a dollar at the market." "Look around," Mr. Lee said, his tone impatient. All the other guests were white, with the exception of an Indian couple in the corner, the man in a linen suit, and the woman in a salwar kameez. "These are tourist prices." "These are foolish prices." "Price aside, this is a good restaurant," Vivian declared. Her voice was authoritative, the way she must sound in her examination room in Chicago. Not for the first time, Fung imagined herself in her sister's place, wearing a white coat in a white room, looking out a wall of windows at a haze of white snow. "What do you think?" Vivian nudged her knee. "Too outrageous for you?" "Not at all." Fung hoped that she projected an air of confidence and ease, unlike her brothers. Hank and Fook were speechless, their silk-bound menus considerably more handsome than any textbook they owned. "I could get used to this. That's a spirit." The guests at the neighboring table rose, and on the way out, two of them paused beside Fung, the brunette taking a photograph of the musicians strumming their zithers.
"They're just like butterflies,"
she said in an Australian accent, squinting at the image on her camera. Eavesdropping on them, Fung was relieved not to be the object of their fascination.
"So delicate and tiny. I'll bet they never worry about what they ate."
Her friend flipped open her compact to inspect her lipstick.
"Those dresses look stitched onto them."
Night after night, Fung had observed the customs of tourists like these, her degree in biology no more than a memory as she opened the doors of Namca with a small bow. Having come to dine on elegantly presented peasant cuisine, the guests were suitably impressed by the Cham statuary, by the Chinese scrolls hanging upon the walls, and by Fung herself, her slim and petite body sheathed in a golden, form-fitting aoyai. Sometimes guests would ask to photograph her, requests that were initially flattering but now usually irritating. Still, she could not decline, as her manager had made clear, and so she would force herself to smile and tilt her head, a trellis of hair as black and silky as her trousers falling over her shoulder. Striking this or another pose, Fung could pretend that she was not a hostess doing a foreigner's bidding, but rather a model, a starlet, her sibling's namesake. What she actually looked like she never knew, for while everyone promised to send her the pictures, no one ever did. When she arrived, Vivian carried with her a schedule of the sights she wanted to see, complete with estimated travel times via train, bus, car, hydrofoil, or plane. President Clinton had come the year before, his much-celebrated visit reassuring her mother that Vivian's return would be a safe one, especially when armed with a U.S. passport and dollar bills. So equipped, Vivian had overcome her father's token resistance and paid for the family during all of their outings.
"I'm the doctor, aren't I?" she said.
While Fung was impressed by Vivian's approach, as if vacationing were a job at which she sought promotion, she was not surprised. In the occasional dispatches sent by Vivian's mother, a picture had emerged of an independent young woman, the unmarried pediatrician who had backpacked solo through Western Europe and vacationed in Hawaii, the Bahamas, Rio. Mr. Lee, who made a humble living as a tour guide, reviewed the itinerary and said, "I couldn't have done better myself." He was a man who rarely praised, except when it came to his first trio of children. His wife had absconded with him after the war, when he had been banished to a new economic zone, and his mistress had come, demanding money. Vivian's mother had been ignorant of the other woman's existence until then, and her response was to flee the country with her three children on a perilous trip by boat. Mr. Lee had learned of their flight in the middle of his 5-year sentence, the loss leading to a spell of shock and depression that he had not shaken off until his return to Saigon. "Life must move on," his mistress said. So he had divorced Vivian's mother, made his mistress the second Mrs. Lee, and sired 3 more children. He often compared Fung to her absent sister, which had cultivated in Fung both a sense of yearning for Vivian, but also some undeniable jealousy. A weevil of envy resurfaced nearly every day of Vivian's visit, for her father was behaving completely unlike himself, as if he were also competing at a job, in this case to win Vivian's approval. Without question or criticism, he followed Vivian's plan for visiting temples and cathedrals, shopping malls and museums, beaches and resorts, south through the Mekong Delta, east to Vung Tau, north to Dalat, and, within Saigon, from the dense, cacophonous alleys of the Chinese Quarter in Jet Lun to the glamour of downtown's Dong Khoi, where Nam Kha was the most expensive restaurant on the boulevard.
"This is like Saigon in the old days."
Mr. Lee smiled fondly, gazing upon the restaurant's velvet drapes and marble pillars. During the war, he had owned a shoe factory, a beach home in Vung Tau, a chauffeured Citroën. Photographs from that time showed a dapper man with pomaded hair and a thin mustache. Now, so far as Fung could tell, He wore his sadness and defeat in a paunch barely contained by the buttons of his shirt one size too small for him. Le Moral on Tailuptang. La Tour d'Ivoire on Janhungdao. Paprika with the best paella and sangria. I always used to go to those restaurants.
Not with me, Mrs. Lee said.
What do you want to do tomorrow? Mr. Lee asked Vivian. She refilled his glass from the bottle of Australian Merlot and said, I left it blank on my schedule. I always leave a day or two for surprises. Can we go to Dum San? Hank asked. Fook nodded vigorously. What's that? Vivian refilled her own glass. An amusement park, Vung said. She was drinking lemonade, as were her mother and brothers. It's not far from here.
I worked in one when I was 16, Vivian said. That was a crazy summer.
We can save Dum San for later, Mr. Lee said.
Since you've seen where your sister works, let me take you on one of my tours tomorrow.
100%. Vivian raised her glass, using the classic toast he had taught her. He clinked his glass against hers, gazed upon his sons affectionately, and said,
Yours is a lucky generation.
I wouldn't say we were so lucky, Fung said. You've never appreciated what you have. Her father waved his hand over the meal, and Fung squeezed her glass, bracing to hear the stories of her parents one more time.
You want to talk about bad luck?
After the Americans abandoned us and the communists sent me into the labor camp, we ate roots and manioc to live. There were worms in the rice, which was mostly water. People caught dysentery or malaria or dengue fever like the common cold and just died. It was amazing we had blood left for the leeches.
It wasn't so much better at home, Mrs. Lee chimed in. I sold everything to survive after the war. My sewing machine, the record player you gave me, and the records, too.
The dumbest part was the confessions. Mr. Lee stared into his glass as if all the lessons learned in the labor camp, once distilled, merely served to fill it. Every week I had to come up with a different way to criticize myself for being a capitalist. I wrote enough pages for a whole autobiography, but every chapter said the same thing.
Fung sighed, but Vivian was listening intently, chin cupped in her hand.
There's something I've always wanted to know. When their father looked up, Vivian said, Why give your children, with your other wife, our names? This was the question Fung had never asked, fearing the answer she always suspected, that she and her brothers were no more than regrets born into flesh. Vivian's forthrightness, however, did not appear to surprise or daunt their father, who merely raised his glass and said, If you hadn't come back to see me, I would have understood. But I knew you would come back to see the one I named after you. Vivian glanced at Fung, who maintained a stoic expression. After all, it wasn't Vivian's fault their father behaved the way he did, playing favorites and pitying himself.
So here I am, Vivian said.
She returned her father's gaze and clinked her glass against his. And here's to us.
100%, Mr. Lee said.
For all the years that Mr. Lee had worked as a tour guide, he had never asked Fung to accompany him on one of his trips. Although she had never wanted to go, she realized the next morning on the tour bus that she would have liked to have been asked. Vivian did not seem to appreciate their father's special regard for her, or her fortune in even being a tourist on this day, the boys left behind at school, and Fung's mother busy at the Bentang market. Instead, Vivian focused her attention on the crowded conditions of the aging bus, whispering complaints into Fung's ear about the long-haired, budget-minded backpackers who jammed the thinly cushioned seats and made their father's company a success. Then, embraced by clammy weather once they stepped off the air-conditioned bus at Bendin, Vivian could only mutter that this was not exactly her idea of fun.
I don't even like camping, Vivian said as the sisters trailed behind the other tourists, winding their way through the eucalyptus trees and bamboo groves where the fabled tunnels of Guji were preserved. I'd rather be in a shopping mall or a museum, but even the museums don't have air conditioning here.
Father wants you to see him at work, Fung said patiently. He's good at what he does.
Don't tell him I said anything, okay? I don't want to hurt his feelings.
So we have a secret? Fung teased.
Sisters have to have secrets, Vivian said.
Oh my God, what is it? 34 degrees?
This isn't so bad. It's not even that hot.
I'm being bitten. I can feel it. Look at my legs. Vivian's shins and thighs were studded with the pale bumps of fresh bites and the red kernels of fermenting ones. For a pediatrician and seasoned traveler, Vivian had proven woefully incapable of caring for her body. While Fung wore gloves extending to her upper arms and nylons underneath her jeans, her sister wore T-shirts that exposed her bra straps and shorts that were sometimes so brief they revealed the waistband and thong of her panties. Despite her bared skin, Vivian neglected to use mosquito repellent and complained whenever the weather was hot, which was, according to her, nearly every second of the day and night. Her sister's vulnerability was alternately a source of annoyance and endearment to Fung, rendering Vivian less intimidating and perhaps more deserving of the secret Fung longed to entrust, what she had never told her family, and what only Vivian could understand.
"This, ladies and gentlemen, a punji truck."
Mr. Lee spoke in English, beckoning for the group to halt. The 24 tourists, all Westerners, stepped close to the bamboo trap door. He spun it on its hinge until it was vertical, revealing a pit as deep as a grave and as long as a coffin, 12 sharp wooden stakes embedded in the earth.
"Step on trap door, you fall in."
After a couple of tourists took photographs, Mr. Lee waved the group forward. He wore a short-sleeved white shirt and gray slacks with polished brown leather shoes, whereas at home he typically lounged in shorts and, perhaps, an undershirt. What was strangest to Fung was seeing her father joke and chat with the tourists. Whenever he spoke to Fung at home, it was mostly to call for another beer, or to fetch him his cigarettes, or to request a particular dish for dinner.
"And this, an original tunnel."
Mr. Lee stopped and pointed at a square hole the size of a sheet of paper, covered with a wood board and a scattering of leaves at the foot of a eucalyptus tree.
"Here, gorillas live for years and attack Americans anytime."
The tourists were almost all Americans, but this history did not seem to offend them. Instead, they seemed fascinated, raising their cameras as he lifted the board to show the narrow, dark entrance. In the distance, from the shooting range, a machine gun fired a burst of rounds, each bullet costing $1, according to their father. Fung was bemused at how these tourists would want to spend their money and their day here, instead of at the beach, or at a fancy restaurant, or in a hammock at a rustic riverside cafe. The reason for such behavior, her father said, was that the foreign tourists only knew one thing about this country, the war. These tunnels, then, were a must-see on their itineraries.
"Later we see new tunnels made big just for you. Last time an American go in this one, he can't get out. He too fat."
To illustrate his point, Mr. Lee extended his arms and joined his hands, creating a large hoop in the air.
"Anyone want to try?"
The tourists grinned and shook their heads, the smallest of them as tall as Fung's father. Fung was afraid he might call on her to slide into the tunnel, but when no one volunteered, her father scowled and raised his fist.
"This is how we win our victory," he cried.
A camera flashed.
"We reunite our country through courage and sacrifice."
2 more cameras flashed as their father held his pose.
"Did he just say what I think he said?" Vivian whispered.
"He doesn't really mean it. It's only an act." But Fung suspected that for the tourists, act was fact. Foreigners that they were, they could not tell the difference between a communist and a man the communists had exiled to a new economic zone. In a few days, or a week, or 2 weeks, they would leave. Their most vivid memory about this day being the funny experience of crawling on their knees through a tunnel, with a vague memory of the passionate little tour guide and his somewhat quirky English. "We're all the same to them," Fung understood with a mix of anger and shame. Small, charming, and forgettable. She was worried her sister might see her in this way as well, but when her father waved the tourists onward and Vivian followed, she appeared to be concerned only with brushing away the small cloud of mosquitoes hovering around her. On Vivian's penultimate night in Saigon, she and her father drank 4 flasks of milky rice wine at a Chinese restaurant in Jetlun. After returning home, he went for a walk with his wife to clear his intoxicated head, while Hank and Fulk settled down on the blanketed floor of the living room, their bed next to the motorbikes. Upstairs, after Vivian closed the door to the room that Fung shared with her parents, she pulled one of her crimson suitcases out from underneath Fung's narrow bed. The suitcase had been loaded with gifts from Vivian and her mother, from jeans and shirts to medicines and makeup, even shampoo and conditioner that had been bottled in the United States and were hence more valuable than the same brand bottled in a local plant. Now the suitcase was packed with souvenirs, a porcelain doll in a silk aoyai for Vivian's mother, hand-carved teak replicas of siklos for her brothers, a bottle of rice wine with a cobra floating in it for her stepfather, and, for her friends, T-shirts emblazoned with Ho Chi Minh's avuncular face. But when Vivian opened the suitcase, she took out neither these mementos nor her own belongings. Instead, after rummaging underneath them, she dug out a small pink bag, somewhat crumpled from its journey, and presented it to Fung. "I've got one last thing for you, little sister," Vivian said. "I wasn't sure I should give it to you, but I thought I'd come prepared." Printed on the bag in cursive writing was Victoria's Secret. Inside were a black lace brassiere and black lace panties, a wispy thong rather than one of the scratchy, full-bottomed cotton affairs that Fung's mother bought for her in packages of a dozen. "I can't wear these," Fung said, blushing. "They're scandalous." "Go on, try them on." Vivian pulled the nearly non-existent panties from the bag and pressed them into Fung's hands. "Can't imagine you in those granny things you have." For a moment, Fung hesitated. But Vivian was her sister and a doctor, and there was no need to be shy. She quickly stripped off her rayon pajamas and her cotton underwear, and just as quickly slipped on the brassiere and panties. Vivian nodded approvingly and said, "Now you look sexy. Some boy's going to be very lucky to see you in those." "My mother and father would never let me wear these." Fung hesitated, but then reached for the hand mirror hanging from a nail on the wall. The touch of lace against her skin and the glimpses of her nearly nude body, draped so provocatively, were thrilling. Only naughty girls would wear this. "It's time for you to be bad," Vivian said, yawning. "My God, you're 23. You don't even want to know what I was doing when I was 23. Even after Fung had put her pajamas back on, she could still see how she looked in the hand mirror, the flashes of skin against the strip of gossamer fabric. She drew the curtain separating her side of the room from her parents and slipped into bed with Vivian, who had put away the suitcase and donned her own pajamas. Lying there, arm by arm, she sensed that her sister's gift had endowed their relationship with even more intimacy and trust. "What's the first thing you'll do in Chicago? Call your mother?" "Take a long drive by myself. I miss my car. I don't even know anyone who owns a car." Vivian stared at the ceiling fan, stirring the hot air of a typically humid night. The open window allowed in only the merest of breezes. "Can I tell you a secret?" Vivian said. "You already told me." "What? A secret?" When Fung turned her head, she could see into Vivian's ear the canal, small and dark. "At Gucci." "I guess I did." Vivian scratched a bite on her neck. "I thought I would come here. And I would love my father." "You don't love him?" Fung popped her head on her hand. "Or you didn't love him?" "It's easy for you to love him," Vivian sighed. "It's easy for him to love me. That's the way it should be. He remembers me. I don't remember him. Can you love someone you don't remember? Can you love someone you don't know?" "I'm not sure." A burst of cackling and laughter came from the alley outside, the neighborhood's old ladies sitting on their thresholds, gossiping before bedtime. "But I know he's not easy to love. A woman can't fall in love with a man for whom she feels sorry, can she? I've never fallen in love with anyone, so I don't know." The screech of the metal gate that was the living room's front door announced their father's return. "But you're saying it wrong. You're not falling in love. You just want to love him." "You know what my mother told me when I said I was going to Vietnam?" Vivian paused. "Your father's only going to break your heart, too." Then Vivian rolled over on her side to face the wall, where a green gecko clung patiently to the plaster. The stairs creaked as Mr. and Mrs. Lee ascended, the discordant notes together comprising a coda to Fung's day so familiar, only Vivian's arrival made her aware of it. Her sister's presence in Fung's bed and the caress of the lace on her skin sharpened the dull pencil of Fung's perceptions, allowing her to write in her mind with ever-increasing precision the outline of the characters in her life. None was drawn more clearly than her father, whom she pitied and, even worse, did not respect. If he were only an adulterer and a playboy, then there would be cause for resentment, but he was in decline, a failure without even the glamour of decadence and bad behavior. This was a matter of sufficient sadness and embarrassment, so that when her father's shadow appeared in the doorway, Fung turned on her side as well. There, pressed into her sister's back under the weight of a humid night, she discovered that even lying down, Vivian had broken into a sweat. At the amusement park the next morning, Mr. Lee photographed his children at the entry gates with a disposable camera, a gift from his ex-wife, delivered by Vivian. After Vivian paid for the family's fares, Hank and Fuchs seized the lead, the former tugging on his mother's hand. They picked their way through raucous troops of elementary school boys and girls, a battalion in red shirts and caps. A monorail traversed the park above the keen crowds, and in the distance, a roller coaster rumbled. One exhibition hall soon caught Fung's attention, its curious English name being the Ice Lantern. On a billboard outside, brightly colored photos depicted glacial facsimiles of the Eiffel Tower, the Taj Mahal, and other man-made wonders of the world, lit in a rainbow of neon. "Let's save this for later," she said, "when we need to cool down."
"Good plan," said Vivian, fanning herself with a park brochure.
After driving the bumper cars at Hank and Fuchs' request, Mrs. Lee insisted on visiting the Japanese orchid garden. Several young couples posed for wedding photographs in different corners, the veiled brides in Western wedding gowns and the grooms in white tuxedos, red roses pinned to their lapels. Mrs. Lee cooed over the spectacle, but Hank and Fuchs rolled their eyes and asked Vivian if the next destination could be the Ferris wheel, rotating slowly above the water slides. It was Mrs. Lee who clambered into one cabin of the Ferris wheel with the boys, while Mr. Lee declined to join his daughters in another cabin, claiming acrophobia. As they ascended, Vivian studied the scenery from the barred window on her side, below which someone had drawn on the blue wall the stick figure of a girl with a mop of hair, fingers flashing a V. Fung peeked over her shoulder, her breath tickling a hair on Vivian's ear. Vivian tucked away the hair and pointed toward the roller coaster climbing slowly into view, an upside-down caterpillar with dozens of human arms wiggling in the air. "I worked on a ride like that," Vivian said. "All my friends found jobs at the park so we could meet boys."
"Did you find a boyfriend?"
Fung leaned a shoulder against her sister's arm. She hadn't told Vivian that she was still wearing her gift, delighting in it like a child with a new and magical toy. "Was he handsome?"
"Rod was cute. He'd give me rides home, and we'd go on one of the side streets around my house, park, and kiss."
"I don't suppose you've done that."
"Not yet."
"You haven't found any boys you like?"
"I don't want any attachments," Fung said firmly. "I don't want anyone holding me back."
"From what?" At the center of the park was a lake the size of a saucer, crumbs of paddle boats floating on its surface. Jutting into the lake was their noon destination, a restaurant in the shape of a dragon's head, dividing the waters as Vivian's departure tomorrow would divide the world once more into those who stayed and those who left.
"Can I tell you a secret now?"
Vivian smiled.
"Sure."
Fung searched for the words to say what she had never told anyone before, how one day she, too, would leave. For Saigon was boring, and the country itself not big enough for the desires in her heart.
"I want to be like you," Fung said, gripping her sister's hands in her own.
"I want to go to America and be a doctor and help people. I don't want to spend my life waiting on people. I want to be waited on. I want to travel anywhere I want, anytime I want. I want to come back here and know I can leave. If I stay here, I'll marry some boy with no future and live with his family and have two children too soon and sleep in a room where I can touch both walls at the same time. I don't think I can stand it. I really don't. Haven't you ever felt this way?"
"Oh, God," Vivian said, looking up at the ceiling of the cabin.
Fung had hoped for enthusiasm and would have settled for reluctance, confusion, or condescension, but she was not prepared for the panic on her sister's face.
"I told her she should have told all of you the truth."
The roller coaster plunged down the tracks, the passengers screaming. When Vivian shifted her weight and pulled her hands free, her arm peeled away from Fung's shoulder with a moist suck of sound, the air no cooler than down below.
"Who are you talking about?"
"My mother." Vivian took a deep breath and looked once more through the barred windows.
"Did you know that when she came to the States, she told the government she was 25?
"So?" A drop of sweat trickled down the small of Fung's back.
"She was 30.
I can see a woman doing that. My mother also told the government she was a widow." Vivian turned back to meet Fung's gaze.
"She wasn't telling the truth when she told our father I was a doctor."
Fung blinked.
"You're not a doctor?" "I'm a receptionist without a job. I was let go the month before I came here.
My mother and my stepfather do not own a house in the suburbs. They live in a condo in West Tulsa. And my mother does not own the Nice Nail Beauty Salon. She works for it as a beautician."
"Then why tell us you were a doctor?"
"Because you all wanted to know how much I made a month and what I paid on my mortgage and how much my car cost. It was easier just to answer than to say I wasn't a doctor. But just so you know, that whole story about me being a pediatrician was my mother's idea, not mine. The cabin had reached its zenith, an elephant chained by its ankle visible far below, a wind-up toy tottering back and forth. My mother also told me not to date my boss, especially if he's married. Your boss? What's he got to do with this? He said it wasn't me, it was the economy, Vivian cried. Have you ever heard anything so stupid?
No, Fung said. No one's ever broken up with me before.
It happens to everybody. Vivian's eyes moistened. So I thought I'd come here. A stupid reason, isn't it?
I thought you came here to see us.
That too. Where's all the money coming from?
Fung could not tabulate how much her sister had spent, but she knew it was in the thousands of dollars.
Just the gift envelopes alone that Vivian had distributed on her first night in Saigon held $600 bills for Mr. and Mrs. Lee, with two more for Fung, and one each for her brothers.
All the dinners and tickets. The trips to Dalat and Vung Dao.
In America, they pay you extra when they fire you. Even receptionists get a nice check from big companies. Vivian fumbled in her purse as their cabin continued its descent. I also have credit cards. I don't mind spending money. I wanted to show you a good time. You've never been anywhere. The park's most prominent landmark loomed before them, a mountain painted in alluvial red, hollow and metallic.
It doesn't matter, Fung said.
None of it did. Neither the lies, nor the fact that Vivian had everything, even Fung's name, which she didn't care to use.
You don't have to be a doctor to sponsor me.
Where are my tissues? Vivian wiped her tears away with her hands.
I won't bother you.
Fung touched Vivian on the arm, sticky with perspiration. Their cabin was nearing the platform.
I'll find a job. I'll take care of myself. I'll take care of you.
Vivian snapped her purse shut, still crying.
I'm sorry, Fung. When I return, I'm putting my life back together. I've got to pay off 4 credit cards and my student loans and hope my house won't be taken from me. But I won't have time to worry about a little sister.
Now it was Vivian who seized Fung's hands with her own tear-dampened ones.
Can you understand that, please?
When the attendant opened the door, their father was waiting, disposable camera held to his eye, his wife standing behind him with the boys. The Ferris wheel rotated at its measured pace, slow enough for them to step out, Vivian first. A week later, their father would develop the photograph, but it would take Fung a moment to examine the laminated picture before she remembered what was absent underneath the clear plastic. Vivian was visible in the doorway, eyes moist and makeup smudged. But by an accident of timing or composition, Fung herself could not be seen. While it had taken Vivian 27 years to mail her first letter home, it took her only a month for the second missive. Fung returned one evening from Nam Kha to find her parents and brothers clustered around the table in the living room, sifting through a stack of pictures that Vivian had enclosed. A smiling and cheerful Mr. Lee waved the letter at Fung, a single sheet that she read sitting on the arm of the couch. The letter recounted Vivian's wonderful memories, dining on a floating restaurant on the Saigon River, being fitted for a custom-made ao yai, riding on a pony cart around Lake Xuan Hung in Dalat, with the best day her arrival, and the worst, her departure.
I looked out the window of the airplane until I couldn't see the country anymore, she wrote. Everything's so green.
The moment the clouds covered it, all I wanted was to return. And so the letter went. Her sister's hypocrisy making Fung so ill that it was all she could do not to tear the letter in half. Tomorrow I want you to have these pictures laminated, Mr. Lee said, sorting through the photographs Vivian had sent. We'll make an album from them.
What for? Fung said, tossing the letter onto the table.
What do you mean, what for? Mr. Lee was incredulous.
So that we'll have something to remember her by until she comes back.
Fung studied her father as he sat on the couch, surrounded by her mother and brothers, clutching the photographs as if they were equal to the $100 bills Vivian had given him. For the first time in her life, she felt pity for him, certain that it was not just her father who would break his daughter's heart, but the daughters who would one day break his. She contemplated telling him this truth, that Vivian was never going to return, and that one day, perhaps not soon, but eventually, Fung would leave as well, to a world where she could fall in love with someone she didn't know. It was merely a matter of momentum, and she now knew how to begin. By 9 the next morning, she was alone in the house, the boys gone to school, her parents at work. She wore her sister's gift, and over the lace donned a blouse and capri pants. It would be best, she thought, to do what needed to be done outdoors, and so she placed a stool by the living room gate and a tin bucket on the pavement of the alley. When she opened the envelope of photographs, the first picture she saw featured her father and Vivian shivering in the ice lantern at the amusement park, their last stop that day. In the foyer, an attendant had handed them polyester parkas, hooded, knee-length, and in neon hues of yellow, pink, orange, and green. Even wearing the parkas, stepping from the foyer into the ice lantern itself was a shock, for it was in essence an enormous refrigerator, an echoing hall that offered a walking tour of the world's tourist landmarks, rendered as ice sculptures no taller than a man's height. Dazzling neon lights in the same spectrum of color as the parkas illuminated the sculptures, the scurrying crowds, and a pair of long chutes, also carved from ice, down which shrieking children slid. "This is weird," Vivian had said, hunching her shoulders from the cold as she stood before a miniature London bridge. It was in front of this bridge that Vivian and her father posed for the photograph, not far from the frozen pyramids of Egypt and the rimy Sphinx. While Fung aimed Vivian's camera, father and daughter wrapped their arms around each other's waists. Fung had taken the picture mechanically, not paying much attention to the small digital image after it flashed up on the camera's screen. But now, holding the photograph as she sat on the stool, she could focus on its details. With their hoods over their heads, only her father's and sister's pale, triangular faces were visible, two white petals floating on lily pads of neon green. In the ice lantern's glow, her sister's face looked more like her father's than her own, the symmetry rendering clear what Fung could now say. Their father loved Vivian more than her. The photograph ignited easily when Fung lit it with a match. After she dropped the photo in the bucket, she watched it curl up and shrivel, remembering how Vivian had approached her after she took the picture and tried to make amends. "I never thought I'd say this here," Vivian said, smiling as she clasped Fung's hand, "but I'm cold." Even a month later, Fung could feel the chilliness, and how she had shivered and turned away toward Egypt's crystalline sand. She fed the fire with more photos and their heat warmed her, 2 dozen others disappearing until only one was left, of Vivian and Fung at the airport on the morning of Vivian's departure, Vivian with her arm around Fung's shoulder and flashing a V sign with her fingers. Unlike her sister, Fung was not smiling. Their father had forced her to wear an aoyai for Vivian's departure, and she looked serious and grim in its silk confines. Hers was the expression that older people of an earlier generation usually adopted as they stood before the camera, picture-taking a rare and ceremonious occasion reserved for weddings and funerals. The photograph flared when she touched it with fire, Vivian's features melting before her own, their faces vanishing in flame. After the last embers from this photograph and the others had died, Fung rose and scattered their ashes. She was about to turn and enter the house when a gust of wind surged down the alley, catching the ashes and blowing them away. A flurry rose above the neighboring roofs, and she couldn't help pausing to admire for a moment the clear and depthless sky into which the ashes vanished, an inverted blue bowl of the finest crystal, covering the whole of Saigon as far as her eyes could see. Acknowledgements. Thanks to the editors who first printed these stories. Thanks to all the wonderful people at my publisher, Grove Atlantic, most especially Peter Blackstock, who said these stories were good enough. Thanks to my father and mother, Joseph and Linda, refugees in 1954 and again in 1975. They are the most courageous people I know. They saved my life. Thanks to my older brother, Dong, the original refugee success story. 7 years after arriving in the United States, he went to Harvard. He sets a high standard. Thanks to Lan Yung, my fellow refugee, writer, and partner, a reader of my every word, she has shared both the suffering and the joy. Thanks to our son Ellison for reminding me of childhood. By the time this book is published, he will be nearly the age that I was when I became a refugee.
This has been an Audible Studios production of The Refugees, Written and performed by Viet Thai Nguyen. Producer Mike Charzik. Copyright 2017 by Viet Thai Nguyen. Recorded by arrangement with Grove Atlantic, Inc. Versions of these stories collected here were originally published in the following publications. Black-Eyed Women, in Epoch, 64.2. The Other Man, published as A Correct Life, in Best New American Voices, 2007. War Years, published as The War Years, in Tri-Quarterly, 135 of 136. The Transplant, published as Arthur Arellano, in Narrative, Spring 2010. I'd Love You to Want Me, published as The Other Woman, in Gulf Coast, 20.1. The Americans, in the Chicago Tribune, December 2010. Someone Else Besides You, in Narrative, Winter 2008. Fatherland, in Narrative, Spring 2011. Production copyright 2017 by Audible, Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible, Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.